instances at 9/11, and then so that work is continuing. I just ask you to take some time to look that over. And if you'd be in prayer, the elders will meet in the next 10 days or so to review the progress that's been made to date and make some decisions about how we will bring that back to you as a larger congregation. And then finally, we talked about this book over Advent, a good introduction to the church calendar and how we enter into the different seasons of the church year. Some of you said, oh, I didn't get a copy and we're now in ordinary time. What does that mean? And Lent starts in about 6 or 7 weeks. If you are interested in that, we have more copies now. They're back at the info desk. $5 would get you a copy of that if you want to just continue to walk with us. We'll talk more about that again as Lent starts in a few weeks. Pastor Todd.
Let's just express our appreciation for those that led us in worship this morning. I think it's just a good culture for us to engender privately in our families, in church, everywhere we go, and that is never take anything for granted. People work hard on your behalf, give themselves to bring something special to you. Never take that for granted. The old adage, I live by it, and it's this, what you do not value, you will inevitably lose. And so I try to value things, value people very, very highly. And so lovely to see so many familiar faces today. And this is my first time preaching at the beginning of this new year. And I have a heightened sense of expectation for 2014 and what awaits us. And I'd like to outline some of my reasons for that, even in our time this morning. I'd like to begin with a scripture reading from the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah 64, and just a single verse from that chapter. And through the course of this morning, I hope you'll come to understand and appreciate this all the more. Here's Isaiah's prayer. Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains might quake at your presence. Lord, bless this public reading of your word. When I look around this morning, I see so many new faces, people that are here even within the last 6 to 12 months. And I want to just give a couple words to you first. Number one, it wouldn't be wrong of you to ask, where exactly is this church heading? What exactly is this church all about? In fact, I want to encourage that kind of questions. That's a healthy line of questioning. When I was younger, I used to ride the Greyhound bus quite a lot in this country. And of course, there's quite a lot of public transportation in the United Kingdom. And so I've ridden it quite a lot. But when I used to ride the bus, I had this anxiety always for some reason about getting on the wrong bus. And always thought, what would happen if you got on the wrong bus and you ended up at the completely wrong part of the country or something? And so I would ask someone in the queue, is this the bus to so-and-so, to somewhere? And they would go, yes, this is the right queue. And then, but only with a few minutes, I'd think, what happens if they got it wrong? So I would wait for the bus to pull into the terminal, and I would put my suitcase down to hold my spot. And then I'd go, look, because at the front of the bus, there's this very handy sign. It shows where the destination of the bus is. And then, of course, almost every time, maybe every time, it's the same place that was the person in the queue said. So I was relieved. Take my spot in the queue. I'm in the right place. Go in the right direction. But if two witnesses are good, three are better. And so I inevitably found myself wanting to say to the driver, are you sure? Is this the bus to my destination? Yes, this is the bus to that place. Because now some part of me can settle. I am not going to end up in the completely wrong place of Canada. Or at least if I am, I'm in good company. There's lots of us that are going to end up there. And so if you're new here, it's not wrong for you to ask a few people in the queue, where exactly is this bus heading? And I don't know where our equivalent is to the sign on the front of the bus, that handy sign, but maybe our webpage or some of our sermons but wherever our equivalent is for you to be able to go around and ask, I wonder where this bus is going, so I'm making sure I'm getting on the right bus. But in one way or another, it's a good question to ask. What are these people about? What are their greatest passions? Where are they going? And what is their direction? What is their destination? And as obvious as that might be if you're new to ask those questions, those aren't questions that should only be asked by new people. For those of us who have been here for many years, it is equally important to gain again a clear sense of understanding on this matter. Even if you've been here for 10 or 20 years, to once again ask, where's our destination again? Where are we going? Because our passions in life are the product of our journey. We're not born with a set of passions, but convictions develop over time. And passions develop through life experience. You end up having a set of passions, things that are highly important to you. But it's life that makes them highly important to you. And it's not usually the easy things in life that make them highly important to you. Sometimes it's the tougher things of life. And so I have a set of passions that are the product of my journey. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about maybe some parts of my spiritual journey today, because it may help you make sense of some of our destination as a church. So first of all, I did not grow up in a God-fearing family. I was never in church as a family until I was a teenager. But when I was about 13 or 14 years of age, my parents come to faith. And it was the most glorious time in our family. And my parents are here this morning. And so I remember the very first time they ever took me to church. 13, 14 years of age. And it was actually this congregation, not in this location, and not by this name, but it was in our city and just a different location, different name. It was this congregation. And I can still remember the feeling of, and to be honest, the fear of what goes on in a church, having never been there before. If you ask most people on the street what happens in a church, I guess they'd say, well, there's some singing and talking. And I had no idea whatsoever what happens in a church. But some of my earliest, recollections is there was a warm-heartedness amongst the people, and a reception of me as an individual. A sincerity was noticeable. And so numbers of these things, I was positively disposed to that experience. And yet it was sometime during that first year that there I was, my spot in my comfy chair, and probably a little bit zoned out, like, because I couldn't really make total much sense of what was happening. But that's the first time in my life that God spoke to me. He did not speak to me in an audible voice, but it was amongst my thoughts, which were elsewhere. Suddenly someone else's thoughts intruded upon my thoughts and made themselves felt. And I thought, where did that come from? I actually thought that. I wasn't thinking that. Those aren't even my thoughts. And I realized that's God. I didn't know he could do that. I didn't feel like he was being intrusive. I could have thought, like, get out of here. Stay out of my head. These are my thoughts. Fortunately, I didn't feel like that. And this is what he said to me, put in my words. He said, Todd, just because you're amongst Christians does not mean you are a Christian. And it made sense to me totally. But I understand why he said this to me, because I was now in the custom of going to church with my family. And if I hadn't heard that, maybe over time I would think, I guess I'm a Christian. I go to church, don't I? And I could have got a wrong understanding of really what it meant to be a follower of Jesus. And then he kind of showed me, he says, you don't have any objections against Jesus, but being a follower of Jesus is a whole lot more than just not having something against him. It's having faith in him, not just the absence of skepticism. And I realized I had no objections. Exactly like he said, it made total sense. But I didn't know. I didn't know how to proceed from there. So over that next year, I began to learn, what does it mean to believe in Jesus? Maybe for some people that comes a little bit more intuitively for you. I didn't really get that. What does it mean to believe in Jesus? What does it mean to follow him? Well, if I'm a follower, I guess that makes him the leader. So what does that mean to make him my leader? And like, how are you led by someone you can't see? So these were big questions of mine, but they were good questions. If he's the leader, what does it mean to submit to him or his authority? And he has an authoritative place in my heart and life. What does it mean to count the cost? In order to put him first, there's a few other things that need to be displaced. In order to make him of greater value, there's probably a few other things in my life that should be of lesser value because they're occupying his space. I knew that. And so those are not easy things as a teenager to say, wow, what are the things that I might have to give up, or in what way might this new relationship cost me? But I remember I prayed one prayer that seemed to have set the course of my life. That's why I remember it to this day. I've obviously told some of you this privately. But I prayed this prayer. I said, Lord, I owe you everything and you owe me nothing. But if I could just ask for one favor. Doesn't that sound like a teenager? Just a favor. I said, I'll do anything you want. I'll go anywhere you want. But I hate being bored. Could you please make this an adventure? Anybody else hate being bored? I still am like that. Still can't stand being bored. So I asked him, please give me a sense of that following you would be adventuresome. I was 15, maybe 16 when I prayed that prayer. By the time I was 18, I was traveling the world. And I was on the high adventure of a life. God took my 16-year-old prayer. What was in my heart mattered to him. Took me up on it. And I was traveling the world. I was living in England at the time. The year before, I was 17. Sitting in a crowd much like this, there was a man visiting from England, and God pointed me out to him in a crowd. And he spoke to me after the service and said, would you move to England? I'd like to train you in ministry. I mean, how does that stuff happen? But I knew the Lord was in it, so he was a part of the European Billy Graham team. If you know who Billy Graham is still in the younger generation. And so what Billy Graham did on a large scale, this man named Dr. Tony Stone did on a smaller scale. And so he invited me to come and be his understudy. And to travel with him and to train with him. And it was a great time and a time of high adventure. But during those first few months of living in England, there's one day that stands out to me that's relative to what I'm talking about today. And that is that Dr. Tony Stone had a friend come to visit him, I think from Canada. And so he took the day off and decided that he would take this man and drive, show him Britain a little bit. And so I was invited to tag along and ride in the back seat. So we got in the car. We were living in what's called the West Midlands at the time, the central belt of the United Kingdom. And we just began driving west, until we ended up in a place called Wales, which is a whole nother country. I was 18. I don't know where I was during geography class, but I never heard of Wales. A country called Wales? I just thought if you drove far enough out of England, you'd end up in the sea. I had no idea there's a whole nother country there. That is part of the United Kingdom. That's part of what the uniting is. And so we ended up in Wales, which I'd never heard of, and it was beautiful. I love Wales. We've lived there many times now, not just visited there. It's beautiful rolling hills, incredible color of green and sheep in these hills, and beautiful pastoral setting and beautiful little kind of small stone houses, and it just feels like hobbits should live there. It does. It feels like the Shire. Wales does. For any of you that have watched Lord of the Rings, But on this journey this day, as we're driving through Wales, the man that was training me in ministry begins to tell the other man stories of something called the Welsh Revival. I had never heard of it. I never even heard of Wales before. I never heard of the word revival before. So put them together, I was completely in the back seat. Anybody heard of the Welsh Revival? Okay. Anybody that was like me haven't heard of the Welsh Revival? Okay, good. Good company. I never heard of this. And so he begins to relay stories about the Welsh Revival, how that in 1904, God comes to a young man of 17 years of age called Evan Roberts. Part of this experience, he actually has a vision of this giant hand that represents the hand of God. And on it, there's a number written. Strange. 100,000 written on this hand. And God shows a young man what is about to hit the nation of Wales. In the next 4 months, God's power descended on that country and 100,000 conversions happened in 4 months. Such that the entire landscape, socially, politically, economically, spiritually, of Wales was completely changed as a country. Journalists, reporters came from the entire world over to ask what was happening in Wales. And so you can Google it, the Times newspaper, 1905, chronicling the Welsh Revival, talking about what was happening. Because it was so bizarre. The crime rate in the whole of Wales almost disappeared. So magistrates would say that in a whole week would go by, there wasn't a case to try. Because as people put their faith in God and were so moved by God in this, that they didn't want to commit crime anymore. One tavern owner was upset because on a Saturday night, he only sold 9 cents of liquor. Because his normal clientele, all these miners, were all making their way to the little Welsh chapels where they were so caught up in God that they would all be there from 6 to 8 hours at a time. Literally till 3 in the morning, go home, get a few hours sleep, and go back to the mines the next day. The whole of Wales was on fire. Not just something happening in this church or that church, the whole of Wales. And the whole world knew about it, and they came to watch. So here I am, 18 years of age, listening to these stories. I didn't even know such things were possible. Now let me talk about the effect that had on me. Well, it gave me a bigger view of God than I'd ever had before. I don't know what view of God did I have before, but I guess it was smallish. That maybe I saw him as a little bit of a beleaguered being, just kind of hoping someone would believe in him. You know, and hoping that atheists wouldn't pick on him. Because maybe that's the Canadian church at that era, that's going back quite a few years' time, in a sense had that little bit of that kind of the mentality. We're an outpost, the world's against us, can't really hope for a lot, but we'll survive and we'll make it through. And so I didn't realize it had probably come into me a bit. And so this day, as I'm listening to these great stories of the Welsh Revival, something about my view of God grew bigger than it ever had before. I saw him as larger than nations. That the fate of entire nations is in his hands. That he could turn the condition of a nation around at will. And he could do it through a 17-year-old. Like, what kind of God can do that? Literally, he could just decide, Wales, I'm going to do it now. And the whole world came and said, this is amazing. Christians and non-Christians alike were amazed at what God did at a national level. My view of God got bigger that day. And so for the next 17 to 18 years, I gave myself to a pursuit. I thought, I want to learn about this. It's nice hearing stories. I'm not made to just hear stories. I got to be in the story. I got to see that stuff happen. I have never been wired in such a way that just to hear amazing stories. Especially, these are Christian stories. That's actually my God. He was at that point. He wasn't growing up. So in other words, if he could do it for them, he could do this for me. If he could do it in the past, he could do it in the present. And I needed to see this stuff firsthand. And so I began fasting. I began praying, reading, studying, learning. And I gave myself for 18 years to this pursuit. The first 12 were a little rough, maybe a little more, because preparation for it is God took me very, very low before he took me high. I had to experience the depths of his suffering before I could experience the heights of his glory. So he took me through a 12-year period, a dark night of the soul, where any sense of feeling or being aware of God was taken from me. Rats. Love to say I did real good in that time. I didn't at all. I whined a lot for 12 solid years. Love to tell you what a great time that was. I'd just be lying through my teeth. Try hanging on a cross. It's not that fun. Where Jesus said to me, oh, I'm going to bring you into my sufferings. But when that 12 years was done, I'll tell you what, I came up out of a grave. And the power of God and his resurrection power began to descend on me. And I saw things, most of which I couldn't tell you this morning, because it would be just, it'd be too unfamiliar. I'd love to show you pages of the Bible and go, I've been to that place. That's happened to me. That guy visited me. And I got to see the desire of my heart. Just before that happened, kind of the turning point from those 12 years, I was preparing a series of Christmas messages and noticed something in the Christian Christmas narratives that I hadn't noticed before. And that is, there's at least three very significant dreams that God gives to people in the Christmas story. And I don't ever remember up to that point having had a dream that I knew for sure was from God. But the fact they're in the Christmas story, that's pretty orthodox. So I was like, I'd like one of those. I prayed. I said, God, I'd like a dream that comes from you. And I had my first one in only a couple days. And now that is a frequent part of my life. Lots of spiritual activity in the night. I remember that dream like I had it last night. Here's my dream. From God. So in my dream, I'm coming to some place. It feels like I'm coming to some place to preach, because I've been what's called an itinerant preacher, a traveling preacher. So the feelings I had was all the feelings I have of arriving at a spot. Someone's going to introduce me. I'm going to preach. But when I arrive at the location, the building is decrepit. It's very old. It's kind of crumbly. It looks like something out of a World War II movie. Like a bomb has half hit this. And I thought, who would have a young adult service? Who would have it here? Because who would ever come to this place? It just seemed an odd place to have it. Just what would ever attract someone to this place? Nevertheless, I went and found out a door. And I went in. At first, there was nobody there. And I'm perplexed because of this location and its unattractiveness. But then I notice young people start to come in, young adults. But it's not like they're coming to church. There's no chairs. And it's kind of like they're just not even sure why they're there, like God has brought them. But they don't really know. And so I'm thinking, oh, wow, this is unusual. It's not like I'm going to say, hi, I'm here to speak to you. And they began sitting down socially in like circles and just talking. And I realized this is different. So I got on my face before God, like right down, knees, face, you've seen me pray. That's the way I like praying. And here's why. I knew that however we normally go about ministering or preaching, it's not going to work in this setting. It's not going to work. They're not going to listen. It's not going to cut it there. And so the only thing I could think of is, oh God, help me. And I got on my face. And interesting this, as I prayed, oh God, that you would rend the heavens and come down. Come down here. Come down here. That the mountains might quake at your presence. I felt something descending like this. Almost like a heavy curtain. Like maybe you would, a curtain on your window or a blind you would operate and you could just, something heavy like this descending. And it was the glorious presence of God. Just descended in this room. And it was wonderful. And until it enveloped me and I went, oh, he's here. And I was then, I looked up and all of a sudden all the conversations amongst these circles of young people were ceasing. They knew something had changed in the atmosphere. Nobody explained it to them, but they stopped talking. And they kind of looked up wondering what could be the cause of this. And there's this guy praying that they'd never noticed before. So they remain seated, but they kind of swiveled in my direction, like somehow there's a connection between you and whatever is happening. So I didn't stand up or assume a preaching posture. I just swiveled up and I put my legs under me like they were sitting. And I went like this and I said, this? And everybody knew what I was talking about. This is God. And then I talked about him. Not like he was a million miles away. I talked about him like he was in the room. Because he was. And I woke up from my dream. First question I asked, what was that old building represent? And maybe in some ways the church has been a bit bombed out. Not at its best. Maybe it represented the things we put our trust in, that we'll attract people or set, you know, convince them of God. They're eroded. They're old. They're not working. Nobody was there because of that building. And that dream, I realized God was telling me, this is what people need. They actually need, surprise, surprise, they need me. They need encounter with me. They need my presence. Oh, this is what Isaiah said. Rend the heavens. It's almost like Isaiah says, take the heavens and just rip them open, God. Don't let anything keep you from me. Rend the heavens. Come down. In other words, Isaiah wasn't satisfied to just have a relationship with God of him in heaven and me on earth. A distant relationship. He wanted God's presence to come so strongly that even the mountains would quake at the coming of his presence. And so I woke up that morning. Guess what I did the next place I went to preach at? Followed my dream. Careful what I put my trust in. And I just got on my face. And I asked that his presence would fall like that curtain. And from that point on, I began to see things that were like out of the history books, out of the revival books. Summarizing many years. This culminated at an event that was called Avalanche. I had a friend of mine, her name was Sherry McConnell, and she felt from God to start this youth convention to hold it in Kelowna, British Columbia at Nico's old church. She asked if I'd come and be one of the preachers. Well, Avalanche had already been running for 1 or 2 years before I came. But I'll tell you, there was something about this event. I never seen anything from it before or since. In the Old Testament, God showed up to Israel in a pillar of fire. His presence was a pillar of fire. You could see it. And it was a fire by night and a cloud by day. This event had a pillar of fire on top of it. Like, not one you could see, but the presence and power of God was so strong on this thing that when we left every year, we were just like our head in our hands going, what was that? And it was like, I heard people say it. There was thousands of people there. We are at a new level from which you can't come down. We could never forget this. This is being recorded this morning. This will go out all across the web in Canada. Everybody that was at Avalanche will say this. Todd is not exaggerating. If anything, he's understating what happened. Lots of people came from the States. Wow, the things that happened in those days. But 1 year I'm invited to preach there. I'm in my hotel room preparing. And this is what the Lord tells me. The fire, the pillar of fire that is on this event is about to move. So of course in the Old Testament, that's how you get through a wilderness. God said, follow the pillar. So many of us, we want the pillar to follow us. We want to make up our own plans and we just hope God's blessing and presence will follow us wherever we go. It's the other way around. You find out where God's going. Find out where God's moving and you follow him. So he tells me the fire that's on this event is about to move. And I'm a little worried because I don't want to be the guy holding the bag, holding this event when there's none of God's presence and power on it, because that's going to be really awkward. Like, you can't artificially create that stuff. You can't just pull that out of the sermon file. Like, you can't. And so I don't want to be the guy up there with no anointing. And I was just like, oh Lord, where's it going to go to? And the Lord tells me this. It's going to go to the place where I always wanted my fiery presence to dwell. And in my naivety, I said, Vancouver? Because there was lots of prophecies at that time about Vancouver and the stuff that was going to happen in Vancouver. And the Lord said, no. That was the nice version. It's going to go to my church. And I was kind of like, pardon? And he let me into something. I had, that hotel room, the things that he spoke to me, I still live out of those things. They shaped me that day. This is what he let me into, his sadness. When at the close of this event, 2,000 young people would be sad because they would say, now I got to go back to my home church. Boring. And I felt like the Lord's sadness and saying, do you think that's the way I intended it to look like? Do you think I would create church that young people would go, boring, who wants to go? And he just let me into his sadness with how far things had fallen. And the fact that he didn't mean for the fire of his presence only just to rest on a conference. It's meant to burn on his church. In the Old Testament, it was over the tabernacle. That's where the fire burned, over the tabernacle. Now we are called the tabernacle of God. We are the temple of God. We are the place where his fiery presence is meant to abide and burn day and night. Not just on a one-a-year event. And I could see it. Where have we come? How far have we fallen? That as wonderful as this event is, it's once a year and only affects this one small pocket of of people that every town, every village, every city deserves to have a glorious church with the fiery presence of God there, the real, tangible presence of God. And then I felt like the Lord pulled back a veil and showed me some of his divine strategies. This is my language, so stick with me. I felt like the Lord said that he was going to raise up certain churches called apostolic centers. At that stage, I'd never heard that phrase before. I didn't even know what was meant by that. I'm going to raise up certain churches called apostolic centers, and they will be people who will seek to build my church my way. They'll follow my plan, my blueprint for church. And because they build it my way, it's my house, they'll build it my way, they will see an increase of my presence there. And then I saw that happening, an increase of God resting on that place. And then I saw the region around noticing. I saw the other churches going, wow, what's happening in that church? Why is God resting there in an increasingly heavy and strong and notable way? And I saw in this experience, I saw the churches coming and asking this center. That's what made it a center. It was serving something bigger than itself. And they were apostolic because they're building the way the original apostles did. Building the way that Peter, James, and John, the boys, would have done if they were there building. And so I saw churches coming and saying, asking, why is God, why is his presence so strong here? And I heard their answers, and their answers were always humble. They never said, because we're so cool, or because, you know, answers that suggested some kind of spiritual superiority. Their answers were humble and said, well, God has a plan. He has a blueprint for building his church. And all we're trying to do is follow that plan and build his church in his way. And churches got this idea. And so they went home and thought, we'll start building like that too. Maybe being a little bit more conscientious. And what does the blueprint say? And how does Jesus want his church? And how do we build like that? And so they took those ideas until all of a sudden they began to see the same thing. An increase of the tangible felt presence of God in their midst. Until I saw the fire of his presence being lit in all these churches. But it completely changed my priorities. I'd been a traveling minister, an itinerant speaker. And at that stage I said, Lord, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to just preach in 100 random places a year. I said this, you show me one place that has that call. Because I saw what could happen if one of those places was lit up and became a true apostolic center. I said, show me one place that has that call. I will come off the road. I will not travel again. I'll serve that one place to become that. The first place I got to serve was, I was living in Scotland. And it was a church in South Wales in the town called Llanelli. Hard to say without spitting. Lots of double L's in Welsh. Beautiful how God arranged that. I traveled there every 5 to 6 weeks for the years I lived in Scotland. I kept going back again and again and again. And people from Wales would say, come visit our towns and come preach at our church. I just want one place. It can serve you. If there's one place that can be raised up in the country, and I just visited it, I love that church. Just love them. That's my reason for coming here. When I came back to Canada, I felt compelled to. God was visiting me in the night, every night. You got to come back to Canada. It's an important time for Canada. So I came back, and for the first 6 months, he wouldn't show me where to live. I got invitations, but none of those invitations could I feel him in it. Just they're kind, human invitations. And after 6 months, I was kind of frustrated. Why don't you show me where to live? And this is what God told me. Would you really be prepared to live in a place where I'm not? I was like, what does that mean? You're asking the wrong question. You want to know where you live. Ask me to show you the city that I'm going to dwell in. You move where I'm going to move. Well, that made sense. So I said, you show me, you lead me. Whatever the city that you want to light up as a light to Canada, whatever the place that you want to make a center for your presence, through which it would spread through the whole of our country, just you lead me to that place and I'll move there. And I thought it could be a hamlet, it could be 20, 30 people. I literally couldn't care. I just don't want to be living in the best and most beautiful place of the world only to find out I'm in the wrong spot. I mean, the wrong spot for me. And so I know the Lord led me here to the city. And so for 10 years, we've been laboring to ask the question, what is God's plan for His church? What is His blueprint? It's His church. What is His will for His church? And how do we help her become that? And we're in the early stages, but beautiful stages of seeing an increase of the presence and power of God in our midst. So we come to the front of the bus. Where's this bus going? That handy little sign on the front. This is where we're going. And it's fair to tell you, because whose responsibility is it to make us like that? And I guess the answer is all of ours. There's such a vast difference between attending a church and building a church. And I think that over these next months, that God is going to impress the difference on us, where we realize He's not just calling us to attend something. He's calling us to build something. Now you'll have a hammer and I'll have a chisel and someone else will have a level, and we'll all build in different ways and we all have something different to contribute. But if God has got you in this church, and He does, then He has sent you here as a builder. He has sent you here with something to give. He has sent you here with something to contribute, because there is some peace to us becoming a glorious church that is locked up in the vault of your heart. And we need it. Remember I asked God, I'll serve you, I'll do anything, but just don't make it boring. That's why Christians get bored. First of all, they have such a low view of Jesus. They have an even lower view of church. And even then, they just attend once in a while and don't, and aren't contributing much, and they wonder why the whole thing's all boring. What happens if we do this? What happens if we built a more glorious expression of church than anything we have ever seen in our lives? The first Tsar of Russia. Wanted to find a religion for the Russian people. And so he sent out an emissary to go and bring him back some world religions so that he might choose one that was fitting for the Russian people. So the first one that they come back with was Islam. They told him all about Islam. But when the Tsar heard that drinking was prohibited, he said, that can't be the religion of the Russian people. True story. But they went out again and they came back, and this is what they said. They told the Tsar that they had been in what's called a Byzantine Christian church. Google it. Just of a certain era. He said, the emissary says they walked in the middle of worship. And this is what was recorded in history. Whether we were on earth or whether we were in heaven, we knew not of. They weren't sure whether they walked through a door or a porthole. Because what was taking place was so heavenly, so otherworldly, so transcendent, that all they could say to describe it is this: whether we were on earth or whether we were in heaven, we knew not of anymore. Man, when I heard that story, I said, let's build us a church like that. That when people come in, they go, whoa. Like, because there's heaven on earth. Literal taste of heaven on earth. That's what the church is meant to be. And it's not my job to get us there, or Lawrence's job to get us there, or even our wonderful eldership, our elders' job to get us there. It's our job to get us there. What's on the front of that bus? Where's this bus going? Now you'll know. Am I on the right bus? Now you'll be able to answer. Is this a bus I want to be on? I don't mind if there may be a few people that go, not exactly. I'm actually okay with that. But I will say this, don't try to make this bus go some other place. Because it's not going any other place. So this is non-negotiable. Yeah. Because I was made to build a place of heaven on earth. And so even that revival stuff, it's almost like God made me. 10 years I've been here. I came out of that stuff thinking, whoa, what? My friends literally mocked me. You're going to come out of that and be a pastor? In where? Lethbridge, Alberta? But men do not see like God sees. I've been to the very room where that Welsh revival started. Nothing special. Nobody assumed that the whole world would start on fire from that little humble place. No one thought that Bethlehem would amount to much. I got a friend of mine that's been saying to me quite frequently, I was made for more than this. Just life. Oh, I have to agree. They are. Aren't we all? Don't you have that nagging feeling? My friend just woke up to that sooner than the rest of us. Most of us, life has beaten something out of us. So we've just settled at the lowest common denominator. In other words, if I could just survive with my mouth just a little bit above the water, it's better than drowning. But it's not as good as swimming. Really? Just survive with my head above the water? I wasn't made for that. I've been through lots of that. I wasn't made for that. I've been tested in the fires. But I was made for the fire of God. So this is an important year. A year that I need you. If you still feel like our destination is a place that resonates with your heart and calling, then I need you to build with me. Now, some of you could think, wow, the last 6 months or 3 months before coming here was kind of rough. Give me a few healing months first, Todd. It's yours. We'll serve your healing. But as your healing comes full circle, grab a trowel. Grab a hammer. And let's build a little bit of heaven on earth. Sound fun? I love this congregation. When we bought a house, went from a rental to a bought a house just a few months ago, I knew what was happening. I was saying, I spent the last 10 years, I'll spend the next 10. You don't build something glorious overnight. takes a devoting of one's life. Together we'll do that. Could we hang out in the presence of God for a few minutes and just let him speak? Let him just speak to you. Let's just listen. We're not afraid to listen. Okay, I know some of you are new and you're looking at me like, he doesn't really mean we're going to sit and listen. Yeah, I do. So just close your eyes and listen for a minute. What would he say to you? Maybe he'll say, this has got your name on it, but you need a little healing for a couple months first. That's great. Our woundedness prevents us from our destiny. It delays destiny. But if we let Jesus into our woundedness, our wounds will accelerate our destiny. We'll end up further than we ever would have if we hadn't suffered those wounds. So just listen. It's okay for you in God's presence to say, is this what I want? Just listen, that's not distracting me. Let him put some dreams in your heart. Let him come and reinforce that feeling in your heart that says you were made for more than this. Let him come and tell you in his own way that you're not just called to attend church, you're called to build it. You're not just waiting for someone else to make it glorious so you can enjoy the dividends. It's not like someone else plants the garden and you're just waiting around to eat the harvest. You're one of the gardeners. So Father, come speak to our hearts. Someone here asking in your heart, if you could put words to what's in your heart, the words would be this. Is that really possible? That's a fair question. Some of you may dawn on you right now. It's not a coincidence. You're here. This morning, this church, there's a reason why things work out in the providence of God. Because God has unimaginably more for you than you can calculate. If you'll let him make it so. But most of us in life have suffered some wounds, and so we're like a 5-speed race car living in first gear. That's where the wine comes from. There's more power under the hood than you realize. There's way more potential in you. But you don't know how to pop it out of first gear. Or it feels unsafe for you. What would happen if I actually hit second gear? Oh no, I might actually go 50 kilometers an hour. And the last question I want us to think a little bit about is we don't build church for us. We build church for God. In other words, we make this whole thing about our needs. And of course our needs are important to him. But what happens if we build church for God? I think our needs would be met in ways we could never dream, but we still try to build it for us. We make ourselves the center. And if we built it for Him, the kind of place He would want to dwell in, the kind of place where His presence could be maximized. Oh, believe me, your needs. I have been in that place. I have been taken up to heavenly places, and believe me, I didn't sit there thinking, oh, about my needs. He satisfied me I didn't even know was possible. Ecstasy. But the way there is, make this whole thing about Him. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. These are the words of Jesus. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and then all of these things will be added unto you. Matthew 6. And so maybe we only have one 100th, a little bit of understanding. But even with that little bit of understanding, could we say, I'll build this for you. I'll make this about you more than about me. Whatever parts you've got for me, I'll make your house glorious. I don't want to just be an attender. I want to be a contributor and a builder. So let him speak to your hearts. Come, Lord, speak to us. Speak sweet things to people. Speak to them about the parts they'll play. Speak to them about that they've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Speak to them that their best days are not behind them, but ahead of them. Speak hope, faith, and love. Come, Holy Spirit, rend the heavens and come down. That even the mountains would quake at your mighty presence. Father, as we pray right now, we just give your church back to you. This is your church. And all of our expectations, everything must come behind that. We give your church back to you. Whatever decision you're asking us to make in our heart, we'll consider it carefully. We're not going to say something we're not going to follow through on. Is it going to cost us something? Oh, yes. Every good thing does. It's how I show my love. I want it to cost me something. Hallelujah. Father, take us on a journey this year. Take us on a holy adventure. Ha ha ha. Take all of us together on an adventure in God. One that we would never forget. One that would make the history books seem kind of lame. Kind of pale. Now may the Lord bless you. May the Lord keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you. May he lift up the light of his countenance upon you. May the Lord be gracious to you and give you his peace. In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.